We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer, Harriet Williamson, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls. If you look back to the science fiction of 50 years ago, it predicted a future where human beings compelled the universe to do their bidding. In the words of our guest for this hour, James Kakalios, it was a place where we would all travel around in flying cars, we would have jetpacks, people would live in domed underwater cities and have robot personal assistants. From the 30s on, science fiction pulp magazines and comic books promised us that by the year 2000, we would be living in a gleaming utopia where the everyday drudgery of menial tasks and the tyranny of gravity would be overcome. Now, he says, before you complain about promises unfulfilled, you should take a moment, at least, to consider all of the amazing things that we do have now. We have laptop computers. We have DVD players. We have cell phones. We have MRI machines. All things that do amazing work, and things that now we have come to the point where we feel, well, we just couldn't live without them. In this hour of the show, we will be talking about a field that makes all of these things possible. And I'm going to say it now, and please don't go running to switch off the radio. We'll be talking about quantum mechanics with our guest, James Kakalios. He is the Taylor Distinguished Professor in the School of Physics and Astronomy at University of Minnesota, and is the author of a book that's titled The Amazing Story of Quantum Mechanics, A Math-Free Exploration of the Science That Made Our World. Gotham Books is the publisher, and it came out, I think, last fall, so you certainly can find it in the bookstore near you or wherever you get your books. He teaches at University of Minnesota, and he's one of those guys where if you wanted to learn about physics, but you were never going to be a physicist, this is the guy you want to be in his class. He also was an advisor in 2007 on set for the Warner Brothers film Watchmen, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor Kakalios, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me, David.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. I really appreciate it. I have to be honest, you know, but we occasionally have books like this that deal with science. And initially, I always look at them and think, well, that'd be really interesting. Maybe I could learn some stuff here. And I'd say, all right, let's do this show. And always afterwards, I think to myself, when I'm getting ready to do it, I think, no, why did I say I would do this? Because I never quite have the feeling that I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But I keep trying. So maybe sooner or later I will get it. And actually, I think that you do a pretty nice job in trying to explain these things in ways that for people who are not physicists, it'll be possible to grasp. So,
well, thank you very much. I mean, it's certainly true that quantum mechanics, branch of physics, is confusing. And the thing is, it's confusing to us physics professors. Well, we still have arguments over 60 years, 80 years after these concepts were first introduced. So your confusion just means that you're thinking about it at a very professional level.
Oh, good. Thank you.
And one of the most amazing things about quantum mechanics is that one can use it correctly and productively, even if you're confused by it. So quantum mechanics is the branch of physics that deals with how atoms interact with each other and how they interact with light.
Mm-hmm.
And with the knowledge of quantum mechanics, eventually we developed solid-state physics and semiconductor physics. So we offshoots, practical applications of this knowledge include lasers and light-emitting diodes and transistors and magnetic computer hard drives, magnetic resonance imaging, as you mentioned, even something as prosaic as a television remote control is not possible without solid-state physics, without a knowledge of quantum mechanics. So, speaking of the remote control, to the men of America, you're welcome.
Well, let me ask even a more basic question. Take a step back here, if you'll humor me.
Sure.
I think that if I was asked to define biology or botany, I think I could do that. I think I could sort of define chemistry. Certainly, I know what geology is.
Mm-hmm.
But if you said to me, well, all right, what exactly is the province of physics? What really is physics all about? I think I would have to say, well, I'm not really sure. What really is physics all about?
Right. Well, physics is kind of like the umbrella science that incorporates many of the sciences that you mentioned. In general, the standard short definition would be the study of matter and energy and their relationships between the two. So with that, chemistry can fall under the heading because you deal with matter, you deal with the energy of chemical reactions. Geology could also fall within that purview. Pretty much up until recently, we used to stress non-living matter, but there are physicists who are looking into the physics of what goes on inside the cell. I myself have a research collaboration where I collaborate with professors in neuroscience, where I use techniques that I developed to study electrical noise in disordered semiconductors and apply them to voltage fluctuations in the brain. So basically, it's matter, the properties of matter, and energy. And that is a very broad a very broad topic. But it includes things like just classical mechanics, the motion of projectiles or planets or airplanes. It includes electricity and magnetism, because we find that matter has an electrical charge. We find that matter also has a built-in magnetic field. So the understanding of the interrelationship between those two phenomena. It includes thermodynamics, which is the manipulation of energy. It includes then, as I said, quantum mechanics, because that deals with how atoms interact with each other and how they interact with light. And the reason why a whole new branch of physics had to be developed was that when you look at electromagnetic phenomena on the scale of people, we have a theory that works very well to describe that. When we look at the behavior of matter on the scale of baseballs and automobiles and people, again, we have theories of physics that work very well. When you apply them to the inner workings of the atom, the experiments, the observations gave nonsensical results, at least interpreted in terms of the classical theories that we had up till then. So that new theories had to be introduced, new ideas had to be proposed that could be experimentally tested, that could be then checked against the observed properties of the atoms. And from that, we developed this new branch of science called quantum mechanics.
Mm. That's a pretty good deal for physicists to actually be able to say to all other scientists, to say, well, really, everything is physics, you know.
You know, we try not to say that because it just makes us so beloved across the academy.
I'm sure the only thing worse is the mathematicians who say, well, really,
exactly.
everything is
that the physicists do is just applied mathematics.
That's right. Well, to begin where you do, and I think this is really interesting, it's interesting and it's fun to go back and look at the I think perhaps what we now call speculative fiction, with people who were really imagining the future. Going
right
back to the 30s, were thinking that it would be like now, when they were thinking of, well, what was the 21st century going to look like? Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting about it is that it seems that everything in that vision of the future, everything is in motion.
Right.
It's all about people and stuff moving around. And you've written is that there was a fundamental mistake or assumption that people there, as they imagine the future, the kind of future they imagine, what it would be like and where the big revolutions were going to come.
Right. Exactly so. And that's a good point about the motion. Yes, they basically thought that we would have a revolution in energy, which is pretty much what you need in order to have flying cars and jet packs and death rays. It takes a lot of energy to get someone to hover up off the ground. If I wanted to lift my automobile several hundred feet up off the ground, so it could clear the tops of buildings. And the amount of energy that I would have to expend just to keep it there, up off the ground, there'd be hardly anything left over to actually go from point A to point B, which kind of removes the whole point of having a car, whether it's flying or not. So they thought, and why do you need a revolution in energy? Is because the stored energy that we have in from chemical reactions, there's only so much energy available whenever, molecule A reacts with molecule B. One of the reasons why it's so hard to wean ourselves from fossil fuels is that fossil fuels really have a very high energy, a really high bang for the buck, a very large amount of energy per weight of molecule comes about from the fossil fuels. You get more energy per mass from hydrogen reactions, but it's hard to get that much hydrogen in a small in a gas tank at high pressures, where it's relatively easy with gasoline. So if you had a gasoline-powered jetpack, you could take a jetpack to work, provided that you only lived a few blocks from where you worked. You could get much more energy if you were to go to nuclear power, but few people are willing to have an unlicensed nuclear power pack on their backs who aren't a member of the Ghost Bus. But what we got instead of a revolution in energy was a revolution in information. Information is really only limited by the cleverness of the people involved in how to encode, transmit, and store the information. And you can store it by marks on a piece of paper or impressions on a clay tablet, which then when the clay dries is a kind of a permanent record. And we have writing from the Sumerians going back 4,000 years that we can see the information, the stories that were recorded back then, and we can read them here today. That information persists. We can encode the information in a series of using a Morse code, in essence, of ones and zeros. And so that digital information then can be transmitted. And then you say, how do I store, how do I transmit a one or a zero? There's lots of physical phenomena that could have two possible states. A magnet can be pointing with its north pole facing up or its north pole facing down. We could have a positive voltage or a negative voltage. We could have a high current passing through a device or a low current passing through the device. So really there's a tremendous amount of flexibility in figuring out how to encode that information, and thus we can make our devices smaller and smaller, lighter and lighter. There were computers back in the 40s before transistors. They used vacuum tubes to create the ones and zeros that were then processed as information. So if you wanted a big computer, you needed a larger number of vacuum tubes. And they're big, they generate a lot of heat, they're bulky, they're fragile. To make a powerful computer, then, would require to build a computer like the size of the room that you're in right now, or larger. So a few corporations and the government might have computers, but you wouldn't have them in everybody's home. And so there'd be no reason to link them together. There'd be no real reason to have the Internet or the World Wide Web. So a lot of things that we don't even realize came about from the scientists who built the first transistors, the first lasers, and they themselves relied upon work that was done a generation earlier by the pioneers of quantum mechanics.
Yeah. Just to go back to my observation that when you look at the vision of the future that you see in science fiction of the 30s, and I said it's all about movement, everything is in motion, people are in motion, I think that it's true that it's still really all about movement, but now rather than moving people, we're moving data. We're
exactly
digitizing things, and it's much easier to move that than it is to move a person.
That's right. Well, if you develop the right infrastructure. It used to be before Wi-Fi, before satellite communication, you had to move, if you wanted to move information or data, from the U.S. to Europe, before there were transatlantic telegraphs, you had to just take a boat. But it's so that's right. So what we have done is we've sped up dramatically this communication. When you can look at life 50 years ago and look at the things today, we take for granted, the things that we take for granted are definitely were the purview of science fiction. You would never buy a cell phone that does only what a Star Trek communicator from the 1960s could do. You know, you'd say, here's a cell phone, and it only makes calls ship to ship.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take photos, and there's no web access. There's no apps or anything. And it's like, well, you would never buy that. That's like a junky phone. Back in the 60s, people couldn't conceive of the level of stuff that we have today. And again, it ultimately, by going tracing it back to quantum mechanics, you see that it comes about from what we might call, we call nowadays in science, curiosity-based research.
Hmm.
You wouldn't have iPods without transistors and solid-state physics, and you wouldn't have that without quantum mechanics. But if you went to Erwin Schrödinger or you went to Werner Heisenberg and said, nice equations, what's it good for? You know, they're not going to say, well, if you want to store music in a compact digital format, it's not, that's not the justification. They were just trying to understand how atoms behave, why they only absorb light at very particular wavelengths and not at others. And by trying to figure this out, they eventually led the information they acquired about how the world works led to the world that we live in today.
Yeah, and that's I suppose that is your argument for pure doing what one would call quote-unquote pure science, although I suppose pure science doesn't always I guess there are some pure science that really has no potential for yielding some practical application, but a lot of it does.
A lot of it does, and you really can't pick ahead of time. That's the problem, because there's a lot of serendipity, and sometimes you also have to be very patient. Technology and the innovations seem to be coming at a dramatic pace, but when you think about that, the scientific foundations for this for these discoveries were laid down back around 1926 or so, 1925, with the developments of modern quantum mechanics, and the first scientists who first were taking tentative steps to develop quantum mechanics go back in 1900. 1913. So in some cases, it can take a while for these things to really fully pay off. But and not all of it, as you say, does pay off in quite the same way. But you don't know until you're actually there. You only know whether is this trip necessary. You can only answer that once the journey is over.
Our guest in this hour is James Kakalios. He is professor in the School of Physics and Astronomy at University of Minnesota, and he is the author of a recent book. It's titled The Amazing Story of Quantum Mechanics, and it is published by Gotham Books. He's also author of another book, The Physics of Superheroes. So if you're interested in trying to learn a little bit about physics and you would like to be entertained in the process, you can take a look at his books. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. You also may email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I think we have a caller to bring into the conversation in Effingham, so we'll go there. Our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you, David. I have three things. The first is, have you ever heard of, I can't remember his first name, but I read about him many years ago, German philosopher Schopenhauer.
Mm-hmm.
And if I interpreted it right, he stated that there was no meaningful explanation on the origins of matter and motion, how that occurred.
Okay. Shall I take them?
Yes, one at a time, if you would, please.
Okay. To some extent, science would basically agree with that. We know from conservation principles that all the matter and energy, we know from Einstein that they can be interconverted, were present at the Big Bang. And in a quark, what's called a quark-gluon plasma of extremely high energy in an extremely small volume. So the energy mass density was enormous at such a level that we believe that most of our physics equations that we have now don't apply to that at that instant. And from the Big Bang, everything that is around here that we see today, everything in the universe was present at that point. Because if the universe is everything there is, then it had to be there. If you ask, how did it get there, then you enter into metaphysics. And so Schopenhauer, a philosopher, is just as good as someone else to discuss. Some physicists are trying to ask the question about what happened before the Big Bang, and trying to see if there's any thing that they can conclude that could lead to some testable observation. But that's right now at the level of cutting edge. So yes, to some extent I would have to agree, and that's kind of a bizarre thought, that everything that is present here, not in the form that it is today, of course, but all the energy and mass in the universe today was present at the start. And if you ask how did it get there, I say, you know, I just report the news. I don't make it. You have to take it up with the boss.
And that boss, I'm assuming, is where the metaphysics comes in. That,
yes.
That somehow a or he, God, a male, had the original dynamic.
You know, I just work here. that gets above my pay grade.
That I've had this argument more than one time, and a lot of anger erupts out of it. But the thing is that it is inexplicable. Matter in motion, and the old man, the old German philosopher, I think summed it when he said, "We cannot explain that."
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the second point, the quantum mechanics, as I understand it, the process of absorbing and emitting.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
About light, of energy or light. That's right.
Yes, I mean, the whole thing. I mean, we as a species upon this earth absorb light, and then it goes dark. We absorb food. The light, you know, it is not present in our vision.
Mm-hmm.
When it is dark, and we consume food and water and absorb and emit that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's more biology and that's
subject,
more
but
metabolic.
It's true.
But again, they're getting we're extracting
the process.
Stored chemical energy in the food molecules, and converting that to our own purposes. And so there again, you could ask, why do we eat, say, plants or you know, animals that have eaten the plants and derive energy from that, but we don't eat, you know, plastic or stone or metal. And there's chemical bonds holding the atoms together in all of those materials. What's special about plants? And in plants, there is stored energy. The plants have basically done work to create these long-chain starches and carbohydrates through photosynthesis. And it basically takes chemicals and builds a stack of like a building block tower out of them by doing work. And then when we ingest that, we get that stored energy in the tower of blocks. And then when our cell needs that energy, it does a chemical trick that knocks the tower down. And the energy that's released when the tower comes tumbling down, our cells then use for our own metabolic purposes. And so then you can ask, where does that stored energy that the plant uses come? Well, it comes from sunlight, and the sunlight comes from nuclear processes that go on in the center of the sun. And so we can trace back, using physics, we can trace back where the energy comes and use it. And again, we don't understand why stars, such as our own sun, emit light without an understanding of quantum mechanics and nuclear physics. And so we need this understanding has led to, in many different directions, much further than the initial practitioners thought, to an understanding of how the stars shine, to an understanding from that of, you know, why we have our breakfast and why it provides us with energy. We get a much deeper understanding of everything through this knowledge of quantum mechanics.
Yes. Well, the last thing is the I can't remember the scientist, but he was famous. And I learned from that, I think it was on PBS I saw it, that he had this board, and the the galaxy we live in was a tiny little place compared to the mass of other, and I can't remember his name, but he was very famous and the subject matter that you have addressed.
Right.
And then I think it was there that I learned about the dark star, you know, which was formed to create the Big Bang. Is that correct?
I've never heard that expression in terms of a dark star for the Big Bang. I've just heard, usually the phrase that's used to describe the Big Bang is the singularity, where you have practically an infinite amount of mass energy compressed into an infinitely small volume. So you have an infinitely high energy density. And from that, at these energy densities, where all of space and time are compressed into a single point, the laws of physics that we have right now don't apply. Everything breaks down. And so there's a point where right now we're trying the relatively easier questions, like what's going on now, as opposed to what went on back then. You want to look underneath the streetlight where the light's better.
Yeah. I need to jump in here. I appreciate the comments of the caller. I need to bring us back from life, the universe, and everything to just quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
We're talking this morning with James Kakalios. He is the Taylor Distinguished Professor in the School of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Minnesota and is author of the book The Amazing Story of Quantum Mechanics, a math-free exploration of the science that made our world. Gotham Books is the publisher. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here are some other folks to talk with in Champaign. Next, line one. Hello.
Hi. I've been rereading the Harry Potter series,
mm-hmm.
and I've been wondering about matter and energy and how they conjure things out of thin air. I wonder if you're familiar with the series and if you can make any comment about the physics, since I heard that you do the physics of superheroes. I thought
right.
you might be able to do the physics of Harry Potter.
Well, there actually is a book, but not by me, about the science of Harry Potter. Harry Potter deals more with magic, and a fun way of describing magic and trying to reconcile it with our universe that I read once in a comic book written by Warren Ellis was that magic is in essence the cheat codes of reality. And so if you're
what?
The cheat codes.
Oh, okay.
If you're playing a video game, you're trying to get to a certain level. And one of the things I discovered through my teenage children is that there are certain codes that you can get, that the programmers build into the game. And if you enter a certain code, you suddenly have enough energy to achieve a various task.
Uh-huh.
And so you can suddenly do something where normally you're playing the game and you can't get from point A to point B, and a cheat code would allow you to teleport over there to get suddenly to where you need to be. And you might think of magic as somehow having access to these codes, but for our physical reality. Now, it doesn't exist, obviously, these cheat codes. What I did in the physics of superheroes was I didn't try to just apply physics principles to the superheroes because, you know, that's going to be boring. That's going to be, well, this could never happen and this is impossible and what's the deal with the Hulk's pants anyway? You know, I just wanted to be like Professor Grump, Dr. No. So what I did is I granted each character a one-time miracle exemption from the laws of nature and said, well, if you were super strong or could stretch like a rubber band or could run at super speed like Dash from the movie The Incredibles or the comic book character The Flash, could you run across the ocean or up the side of a building, drag people behind you in your wake, or catch bullets in midair, all things that these characters are shown doing, all things that are correct from a physics point of view, once you make that suspension of disbelief. So in the physics of superheroes, I actually cover everything from Isaac Newton to the transistor, but there's not an inclined plane or pulley in sight. All the examples come from superhero comic books. And once you make that suspension of disbelief, I then show what the superheroes are doing with their powers, how they illustrate real physics principles. So Harry Potter is a really fun series. It works on lots of different levels. But in terms of being able to justify the things that he does, no, you really can't do that, I'm afraid, any more than I can really justify. If I could figure out a way to make to get to how the powers of Superman might work in the real world, I certainly wouldn't be working for a living.
Well, I appreciate the question of the caller. Just for me to wedge in a question here, mm-hmm. about the quote unquote laws of nature. There are certain things that we believe that's just the way that they are. One of those things, for example, is that law that says you cannot go faster than the speed of light.
Right.
We consider that to be an absolute. In fact, you know, the problem with interstellar travel is that mm-hmm. you couldn't, even if you could get close, if you could contain a fracture of the speed of light, going back to your thought about the energy future that never got here, the energy requirements would be so great that it would virtually makes it impossible. But that again begs the question: well, who says you can't go faster than the speed of light? I mean, maybe yes, right now we say you can't go faster than the speed of light. But do we entertain the notion that laws are made to be broken, and maybe there's some way to break that one?
Well, here's the deal: we come up with these laws, these theories, based upon what we observe, based upon experiments and observation. And there are a large number of experiments that are 100% consistent with Einstein's special theory of relativity, one feature of which is that there is an upper limit, an upper velocity to the universe, which turns out to be the speed of light. If we come up with another theory to explain faster-than-light travel, this new theory would have to be experimentally tested and verified before we could accept it. You know, it's easy to come up with a theory, but if it doesn't correspond to what we observe, then it's just, you know, it's more like philosophy than anything else. It would not only have to explain this new phenomena of faster-than-light travel, but it would also have to explain why the old theory, of Einstein's theory, seemed to be so correct. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. when we have quantum mechanics, we get different properties inside the atom, but the quantum mechanics explains why when you get to bigger and bigger objects, these quantum effects become smaller and smaller until they're undetectable, so that we can treat large-scale objects. We can ignore, you know, any issues of wave-particle duality or quantization of energy because they're just too small to be detected on the scale that we live. When we deal with relativity, you say relativity, nothing can go. Why do I not notice things like time dilation or length contraction when I drive to work? Because my velocity when I go to work is always the legal limit, by the way, but is also so much less than this upper maximum speed in the universe, the speed of light, that these effects are undetectable. They're so small that they're non-observable. And so to my scale, for my abilities. And so, yes, it is possible that there might be a new theory that would contradict the old theory, but because you never want to say never, science is a constant process of discovery, of doubt, of questioning, of checking, of verification. But you then would have to explain why the new theory has to at least also account for why the old theory seems to be so right. And there are ways, actually, that are consistent with Einstein to go faster than the speed of light. If you could have something moving very fast and the space that it's moving through is changing, is contracting, then you might be able to get from point A to point B in less time than it would take light to get from point A to point B. Or if you're in an expanding region of space-time, it's like being on those moving walkways at the airport. You can, if you run on a moving walkway, you're actually going much faster than the fastest you can run, because the ground you're running on is also moving. And so there are ways to actually go faster than your top running speed if you run on a moving walkway. So there are ways to actually get around that as well. how can we distort space to do this the way we want? That we don't know to do. But the people have thought about ways to actually go faster than the speed of light that are consistent with the known laws of physics. And there are ways around it. We just don't know practically how to achieve that.
All right. Well, let's go to another caller here. Let's go to line two, Will County. Hello.
Howdy.
Yeah.
How are you?
Hi. Good.
I want you to speak a little bit about entanglement. It was first articulated as vaguely as spooky action at a distance, and then formulated in a tractable way by Bell with Bell's inequality. But I would like you to address entanglement as we see it, let's say, in the most recent decade, in particular observable events that are helping us to expose quantum entanglement.
Okay.
And
sure.
I'll hang up and listen for your answer.
Okay. Boy, I'm just getting the easy ones. So, quantum entanglement. So the basic principle of quantum mechanics is that all matter has a wave associated with it. We can describe that. We don't notice this wave when we're, driving to work, because for large-scale objects, this wave can be smaller than a trillion trillion times the nucleus of an atom, so that the wave is undetectable by any means that we can even conceive. But for an electron moving inside an atom, its wave is about the size of the atom. The smaller the momentum, the bigger the wavelength of this wave. And so with electrons inside atoms, these waves are impossible to ignore, whereas for macroscopic objects like baseballs and people, it's impossible to detect. So if matter has a wave associated with it, what happens if I bring two electrons very close to each other so that their waves overlap? Well, if I toss a rock into a pond, I get a series of rings. If I toss two rocks into a pond near each other but not on top of each other, each one will create a series of concentric rings, and as those rings interact with each other, I'll get a more complex pattern. The disturbances, the waves of each rock are now talking to each other. They're interfering constructively and destructively. They are entangled in some sense. Now, this is going to be a temporary phenomena because eventually the disturbance on the surface of the pond dies out and the rings disappear. But imagine if that entangled wave pattern persisted. And now I take the two rocks and I move them very far away from each other, but their wave patterns are still overlapping and still talking to each other, still interfering, still creating a new pattern that's different from one or the other. If I do something to the first rock, it changes the wave pattern that it generates, and that will, through that overlap, that interference pattern, will change the wave pattern of the second rock. And this is possible even if the rocks, in principle, are very far apart, as long as I have a very large lake and nothing else disturbs the lake so that the wave pattern isn't broken. And so that is the notion of quantum entanglement, that you have two waves that can be very close to each other, they interfere, they create a new wave pattern, and then you now bring the individual elements separate, and if you do it very carefully and they don't interact with the outside world, then what happens to one can be instantly, quote-unquote, transmitted to the other just through this wave pattern interference. You think about the disturbances on the surface of a pond, and you can imagine what that wave pattern interference might look like. It's a lot more complex when you're dealing with these matter waves that are associated with the electrons, but the phenomena is more or less the same way. So here's an example of trying to understand some rather complex quantum phenomena, but without getting into the detailed mathematics, and this is the kind of stuff I do in my book. And Einstein hated this interpretation because it left open the possibility that what I do to one electron can be now communicated to the second electron through their interfering waves faster than light. And so it seemed like a way that information could be transmitted that would violate the special law of relativity. The surprising thing is that recent experiments on entangled quantum systems seem to suggest that this is indeed the correct interpretation, that you can indeed get very fast communication, that you can indeed make a measurement done on one electron seems to be instantly transmitted to and result in a change in the second electron, even though they're separated by a great distance. So this is one of those cases where these strange ideas were introduced to explain something rather prosaic, like why are neon signs red? Why are sodium street lamps look yellow? And from these prosaic notions, we led to observations of matter waves, and we get to entangled quantum states. The phenomena of superconductivity, where certain objects, when you lower their temperature, can carry electrical current with no resistance, so that once a current is set up, you don't need an externally applied voltage. The current would just keep going forever, as long as the material remained a superconductor. The electrons form pairs that have unique properties different from individual electrons. And so in some sense, this is, this quantum phenomena of bringing two objects together so close that they now form a new quantum object. And that was actually the theory of that. I just realized who I'm talking to. The theory of that was done by John Bardeen, Leon Cooper, and Schrieffer at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. So the theory, the famous theory of BCS, Bardeen, Cooper, Schrieffer, was developed just down the road from you guys.
All right. Well, here we are, and we have about 8 minutes left in this part of Focus with James Kakalios. He's a professor in the School of Physics and Astronomy at University of Minnesota, and is the author of the book The Amazing Story of Quantum Mechanics, a math-free exploration of the science that made our world, published by Gotham Books. Here's another caller to bring in, and they're in Belgium, line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was under the understanding, and I could be very wrong, that Schrödinger developed a lot of these equations and stuff with actually a concept towards probability. They may be or they may not be where they're at. You know, an electron might be here, it might be over there. Who knows where it's at?
Mm-hmm.
With probability, doesn't that have something to do with it, too? Like, at our level, probabilities are 100% that I'm talking to you right now.
Right.
So how did he make these transitions? Is that
right.
How they make those transitions?
That's an excellent point. And that's actually the part that Einstein and many people have trouble with. Schrödinger's equation, and actually Schrödinger was not the one who introduced the concept of probability as in terms of interpreting his equation. That was done by Max Born a year later. Schrödinger actually disliked this whole probability interpretation, and to some extent towards the end of his life was sorry he brought the whole thing up. But so that's right. So the Schrödinger equation is a very complicated equation, but in its essence, it says, you tell me the forces acting on an electron, and I get a mathematical result out of this equation that when you do something to this mathematical result, tells me the probability of finding the electron at some point in space and time. And if I know the probability of finding it at some other point in space and time, I can calculate things like what is its average location, what is its energy, what is its average momentum, what is its average, you know, rotation or angular momentum. And so, and then you can make measurements, and when you do a measurement on a large number of atoms, you find that the size of the atom might vary, but there is indeed an average size, and it agrees beautifully with the average size of the atom predicted by Schrödinger. If it can tell you how long, what's the average time you have to wait until a radioactive isotope decays, or another way of thinking about this is the half-life. How long do I have to wait until the chance that it decays is 50-50? And so you can have a large number of these isotopes together, a million of them, and after that time period, sure enough, half of them have decayed. The problem is that you don't know which ones have decayed until the time has elapsed. If I have a million people and I tell them to all flip a quarter, then I can pretty much predict that half of them are going to get heads, you know, plus or minus a small fluctuation. I just don't know which ones are going to get heads until they flip the coin. So it's kind of the same way. We can make accurate predictions of the things that we can measure, but the things that we can't get at to see, we don't know. All we can answer are probabilistic answers, interpretations. This is not due to any lack of information or knowledge about the system, but it seems to be built in. It's like Prego spaghetti sauce. It's in there. And we don't know how to get anything more precise out. But since there's no way to actually measure the electron inside the atom without disturbing it and changing it, it's like, how do you measure a wave without interacting with the wave? If it's a big object, it's a big wave, you don't have to worry about it. But if it's a very small thing and very tenuous, then anything you do to it will disturb it, will push it, will change it. Then you have to. All you could do is make assumptions about what's going on when you can't look at it, and then check when you can. And so quantum mechanics is on the one hand, it's led to all sorts of interesting philosophy, but the amazing thing is that it is such a practical a branch of physics. What I describe in my book is more what I call a working man's view of quantum mechanics. We don't get into the philosophy so much as we get into how useful it is. How do you make a laser? How from lasers you get CDs, DVDs, and Blu-rays? How do you make a transistor? And from a transistor you get the USB junk drives. How do you get computer hard drives? Or how does a magnetic resonance imaging device work? That's all quantum mechanics, and it's actually understandable without getting into the equations. And that's what I try to do in my book.
Then, sir, can I point out then that if what you say is all true, then there is a small possibility that we're not talking.
No, the quantum phenomena deals with objects where this wave approach is appropriate. As I mentioned earlier, for large-scale objects, these waves are so small that we can kind of neglect the wave nature of you and I and treat us as real objects. What we call macroscopic classical objects. And in that case, we're either talking or we're not.
We just, I think we're talking, but now I'm not so sure. We have about 2 minutes. Just to come back to Schrodinger for a minute, because as you said earlier, and I don't know if we can do this in 2 minutes, but as you said earlier, Schrodinger and the other quantum mechanics, the guys that were working on these issues, they didn't set out to invent DVD players. What they were trying to do was just to get a better understanding of how the world worked.
Mm-hmm.
So what was in the simplest possible terms, what was the question that they were trying to answer?
Okay. Here's one that'll say very easily.
Hmm.
Why can you look through window glass? Why when you look out a window, why can you see through it? You can see through it because the molecules in the window ignore visible light and absorb ultraviolet light. And they also absorb infrared light. But the visible light passes through. And that means that the molecules and the atoms inside the window can only absorb energy if it corresponds to an allowed transition. I can only move from the orchestra to the balcony in a large auditorium. I can't move halfway up to the balcony. There's no seat there. There's no place for me to stay. So if any energy comes through that would promote me not from the orchestra to the balcony, but from the orchestra to beneath the balcony or just above the orchestra, since there's no place for me to go, I can't use that energy, and I stay in my seat. And the electrons in the atoms and molecules do the same thing. They have only certain allowed energies, and if an energy comes along that is not equal to that transition, there's no place for the electrons to go, and so they ignore it. So that's why we can see through window glass. It's as if you're driving around on a closed racetrack, and you could only go in multiples of 10 miles per hour. So you can go to 10, 20, 30. You can conceive of a speed of 43 miles per hour, but you can never actually go that fast. And if a gust of wind, a tornado, comes and pushes you behind you, and it would speed you up from 50 to 60, then this push can speed you up. But if it would speed you from 50 to 57, you ignore the wind as if it's not there. It doesn't even push, it doesn't push you at all. This is bizarre. But this apparently is the way the world works, and the understanding of this was provided by the scientists who developed quantum mechanics.
Well, if you'd like to read more on this subject, the book to look at, the book we've been talking about here this morning, is The Amazing Story of Quantum Mechanics, the subtitle, A Math-Free Exploration of the Science That Made Our World. It is published by Gotham Books, and the author, our guest this morning, James Kakalios, he is the Taylor Distinguished Professor in the School of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Minnesota. You might also find his book, The Physics of Superheroes, interesting as well. And Professor Kakalios, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.